The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful website building platform. As a Guardian podcast listener, it goes without saying that you're a clever clogs. The good news is that building your own professional website with Squarespace is easy. Whether the site you need is for a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog, getting started takes seconds. Go to squarespace.com today and show support for this podcast and get 10% off. Use the offer code Guardian.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Nicola Davis. Coming up on the show, can virtual experiences elicit the same physical responses as real ones? Where is science and technology taking us next in our search for stranger, more extreme thrills? And should we be wary of the physical or psychological consequences of turning to virtual reality? This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. FutureFest is a weekend of immersive experiences, performances and speakers designed to excite and challenge our perceptions of the future. It's all happening in London on the 14th and 15th of March, and we're going to spend this week and next week's podcast exploring two of the themes of the festival. One session that caught our eye is entitled More or Less Extreme, The Future of Intense Thrills, and I'm delighted to say that two of its panellists join us now. Down the line from Malaysia is Professor Adrian David Chiok of City University London. He's the founder of the Mixed Reality Lab in Singapore. Here in the studio is Professor Brendan Walker, the artist and engineer behind Neurosis, a mixed reality thrill ride. Also joining us is Tech Monthly's Kit Buchan, who recently tried out the Neurosis ride for himself. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello.
Adrian, let's start with you. Tell us about the inventions you're bringing to FutureFest.
I will be showing some of our works about augmenting reality or mixing reality, merging the real and virtual worlds. And, you know, currently the internet is very much about audio-visual. And if you think about it, you normally interact with computers or smartphone. Everything is through the glass or looking at a glass or touching a glass. But in the real world, we interact with all of our five senses. Touch, taste and smell is very important. So we're going to be showing demonstrations where you can stimulate taste and smell using digital devices. We have an electrical taste machine where it stimulates your tongue with just electrical signals to have a virtual taste. Then we have a device called Senti, which you connect to your mobile phone and you can send each other smell messages through the internet. And with regarding to touch, we have a device called Ring You, which you put on your finger. You can squeeze your ring and it sends a mini hug or a squeeze to your friend anywhere in the world through the internet.
And what's the most difficult sensation to sort of send over the internet? Has one been more of a challenge to attempt than others?
Yes, well, both sound and light are waves, and it's very easy to digitize waves. You can easily convert a wave into a number, and that's why sound and then vision has become digitized. But touch and taste and smell are much more difficult, particularly taste and smell, because we actually sense taste and smell in a very different way. It's like a molecule receptor. It's almost like a lock and key mechanism. It's very analog. So the technology we have now for taste and smell is like music was before the CD. You know, if you want to share a song, you have to, you know, record a physical tape and give it to someone. So it's very difficult to transmit chemicals through the internet, and that's why we're working on devices that can directly stimulate your tongue, your taste receptors and your olfactory senses with electromagnetic signals, because electromagnetic signals can be transmitted through the internet, transmitted through radio waves.
One of the devices that you described for doing that, for stimulating the olfactory bulb, sort of sounded like a sort of device that was sort of fitted in the back of the mouth and would then sort of stimulate the olfactory bulb. It sounds kind of quite uncomfortable. I mean, this is presumably supposed to be a sort of pleasurable experience that you're sharing with people. Is there sort of a bit of work to be done in making it sort of really a fun experience?
Yes, I mean, basically, you know, the first stage is really the invention stage. So we're trying to find solutions. How can we stimulate taste and smell without using chemicals? So it's a lot of experimentation and, you know, a lot of equipment and gadgets which are not very mobile, not wearable. But this is the first stage of the technology. The electric taste machine we've been working on for several years. So it's quite small, and the device that we'll bring along to FutureFest, you know, people people will easily be able to try it. For the smell, we're going to show a device you plug into your mobile phone. It actually releases chemicals, so it's an intermediary stage of our research. The device, which has a stimulation using magnetic fields, actually will be a magnetic coil. As you said, we are putting a magnetic coil at the back of the mouth underneath the palatine bone. It's the bone underneath the olfactory bulb. And it'll be something kind of like a sports, a mouth guard. But yes, I totally agree with you. The first versions of it are probably quite uncomfortable. You know, we have to pay subjects and normally the graduate students to come to the lab and we test the devices. But, you know, this is always the first step of the technology. For those who are old enough, you remember the first mobile phones where these looked like big bricks, you know, and people wondered why would anyone carry a mobile phone with them. But, you know, now they've become very tiny and ubiquitous devices. So we expect, you know, once the technology is invented, it can become smaller and smaller in the future. So in the future, we expect, you know, this will be very, very small and devices that will be very comfortable to wear.
You've worked on devices that can transmit hugs and that can transmit kisses and that can transmit smells and so on. Is this basically going to be the future of sex? I mean, is that what we're looking at here as well, a kind of remote interaction mediated by the internet? Is that where you see this going?
Well, you know, we're making these inventions not with any particular application in mind, because I think what we're trying to do is to enhance telepresence. You know, so basically we feel, you know, what I feel is in the future, you'll be able to interact in the virtual world just the same as you interact with the real world. And you think about the real world, kissing is a very important form of communication. You kiss your grandmother, you kiss your children. But of course, you know, sex is also part of human communication. So I think, you know, just like any digital media, people will use it for sex in the future. Already, because of internet, there's a greatly rising phenomenon of long-distance relationships. And you know, people already use computers and video calls to kind of have a virtual sex. And once these devices are invented, then, of course, it will become more realistic and almost like being physically present with your partner. You know, basically, media reflects the society. And so this is definitely one application that people will use. But overall, I think it's not such a bad thing. You know, there's a lot of people in the world that actually don't have any sex because they can't find a friend or they can't find a partner. You know, and once these technologies are introduced, and you'll have virtual sex, you'll have robots which can have sex. And I think this will increase human happiness because actually there is a lot of lonely people, and we can make their lives happier with these technologies in the future.
Kit, you've got a question for Adrian.
Yes, following along on those lines, Adrian, I'm pleased to hear how optimistic you are about the future of what we might call e-sex. But there's still a kind of residual shamefulness around sex or relationships carried out over the internet. And I wondered why you thought that might be and whether or not you think that's going to change.
Yes, I think, you know, technology is always ahead of the social norms, and even something as simple as the mobile phone, I think we still haven't found the social norm. You know, I'm sure you've all had the experience, you go to a restaurant and you look at a couple having a romantic dinner, but half the time they're staring at their phone and I'm not sure what they're doing, they're posting to Facebook or something, so they're actually not really enjoying each other's presence. So even for something simple as mobile phone, we don't have the new social norms. It takes a while for society to adapt to the new norms, but you know, until a few years ago, it was kind of a little bit strange or maybe embarrassing if you said that you met your partner through the internet, you know, those online dating sites. But I was reading some statistics that, you know, for the 20s and below, actually it's now become the majority of people meet online, you know, either through Facebook or online dating sites. So it's become the new norm. I recently watched the brilliant film, The Imitation Game, you know, about Alan Turing and his life. And, you know, we find that pretty sad that, you know, he was persecuted for being a homosexual. So I think, society adapts, and things which we think are really strange or even wrong, society adapts. And I think we tend to adapt society for the better.
Brendan, let's turn to you. Tell us about Neurosis, which you'll be installing at FutureFest. What's this ride doing? What's it all about?
Neurosis is an assemblage of different technologies. Essentially, the rider is going to be sitting on a motion platform, which itself is using new technology, air muscles, to create 6 degrees of freedom of motion. The motion platform's at 2 metres, so the person's going to be elevated, presented to a very large audience. It's almost like a throne to neuromonitoring. The rider then is going to have a neurological monitoring cap put on their head. They're going to have virtual reality goggles put on them. And behind them is going to be a massive 3.6 metre diameter projection. And what starts to happen is that we record their brainwaves live. We use that to generate a neurogenerative landscape in virtual reality, which the person can see and experience through their virtual reality goggles, and also the audience can see projected behind them. And also we're going to create a neurogenerative soundscape. I'm working with an artist called The Mighty Jungulator to create that. And like all fairground rides, the sum is way more than the individual parts. I mean, that's the showmanship and the design. So what people will see is this person on top of a ride being thrown around this landscape that's generated by their own brainwaves, immersed in this soundscape, and it will be a real spectacle.
That sounds incredible. Kit, you've actually tried out this ride. What was it like being strapped in?
I went to the University of Middlesex to Brendan's laboratory and tried out a kind of beta version or a prototype version of the ride. It looks like a kind of spider with a seat at the centre of its legs. You sit crouched in this seat. You put on the virtual reality headset, which contains a gyroscope responding to the movements of your head. But that is initially very difficult to get used to. The moment you put on the headset and you find yourself in this strange and colourful world, and then you move your head and the chair lurches to the side in which you've moved, and you quickly start to lose track of which way in the physical world was up and down. And I think perhaps the strangest feeling about it is that kind of collision between the residue of your awareness of where you were in the room and which way you're facing, combined with this kind of kaleidoscopic, psychedelic world within the headset. You are physically moving around, but it's hard to remember where you are. At one point, I thought I was going to fall off. And I think the finished version of the ride is going to be even more unsettling because, am I right in saying, Brendan, there's a journey within the ride that you're taking in the headset?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, picking up on one of the things you said about tumbling, the motion platform is actually, when it's in the completed ride, is going to be sat 2 metres off the ground. And one of the parts of the performance is that the rider sits on the chair and gets to fully appreciate the heights they're at, and also that they're on the edge of this very real precipice before they are then immersed in their virtual reality world, where they get the sense of tumbling. And so it really is a mixed reality ride that people confuse their virtual experience with the realities of where they are. And the landscape they're whizzing through, well, I kind of liken to the Rose Window at York Minster. That's going to be the final. It's going to be like a moving dynamic stained glass window projected behind the rider.
Brendan, you say that the ride responds to people's brainwaves. So you've got an EEG cap that you've put on people.
Yes.
What actually is that detecting? There's been a lot of kind of talk about the use of EEG caps, particularly in sort of more commercial, less scientific, less medical purposes. Can you tell us a little bit about what it's actually measuring? How does it actually work? What do we actually know about it?
Well, artists have been using EEG in their work for nearly a quarter of a century. So it's the use of EEG creatively is nothing new. But the thing that's really intrigued me recently is that these devices are becoming ubiquitous. You can buy them for $400 or $500. You can monitor 14 channels of brain activity. So they're non-invasive. They're just using a saline solution to pick up micro fluctuations in electrical activity in 14 areas of the brain. And through various algorithms, we can reliably detect whether people are being excited, whether they're in meditative states, whether they're concentrating. And also another unique part of this ride is in the middle. I invite people to train the ride. So it's a bit like training your dragon. And if you concentrate for 8 seconds and think forwards, then from that point onwards in the ride, you can actually have some element of control over your experience. Because up until that point, all 14 channels of data are almost chaotic in some sense. And so there's this element in the middle of the ride of some sense making of all the data, which we then use to help the rider to control their experience.
So it's more looking at sort of levels of activity. You couldn't sort of tell what people are thinking about, but you can just tell which areas of the brain are perhaps, you know, more active than other areas.
Absolutely. I mean, there are parts of the brain which could be linked, for example, to making sense of moving objects, making sense of geometry, formulating responses to experiences you're being subjected to. But none of them are, you know, they're not sort of hardwired. You can't give them scores. It really depends on the context you're monitoring in. But I know in this context, I've got very close, tight control over their experience, so I can quite reliably start to infer some real meaning out of the data.
Kit, you wanted to jump in there with a question.
Well, yes, I did. I mean, you've designed theme park rides or helped design them, and you're a consultant, I believe, at Thorpe Park and Alton Towers. And when I spoke to you last month, you said that you felt the bucking bronco, that famous sort of American bar ride where you sit on a mechanical bull, is for you a kind of perfect sort of performance-based thrill experience. And I just wondered if you could go into more detail on what is it that makes a perfect thrill ride, and even if you could go on to say which currently operating ride is, in your opinion, the best.
Yes. So it really depends on personality type. So there is no one ride which is the best. But the reason the Bucking Bronco appeals to me is, well, one is it's ridiculously cheap in comparison. You know, a motion simulator could be upwards of millions of pounds. A Bucking Bronco you could buy for £6,000. So it's very accessible, and that really intrigues me. But also the fact that there's an element of variability in the ride, so that each performance, the rider on the ride, is very different. There's an element of game playing. There's an element, as you say, of performance, but also there is an audience. It's primarily a spectator experience. And so the fact is that you are performing to many people, whereas on a roller coaster, you can take a solitary ride. Somebody might hear you scream, but, you know, nobody knows you from Adam. And I think it's the rich social dynamics, the social interaction that can be achieved with that kind of performance, which is uniquely different to lots of other theme park rides. Kind of extrapolating that, there is one ride which actually I think kind of mashes up a kind of bucking bronco with a roller coaster, and it's at Alton Towers. It's the Spinball Whizzer. It's like a roller coaster, except the car spins a little bit like the waltzer at the fairground, and it has an element of unpredictability about it. That unpredictability, timelessly, it never ceases to make people laugh with joy every time they are surprised. So it's the element of both physical arousal they get from the ride experience, but also that element of unpredictability, but also, very importantly, who you're riding the ride with. And that, again, that social interaction is very important.
Adrian, are you a fan of fairground rides? Is this something you're excited about trying out at Future Fest?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Very much looking forward to try it. It sounds exciting. I mean, I think this is a very good example. You're taking the output of the brain and then, you know, you're using that to mix the reality. So I think this is going to be very much related to the, you know, future of entertainment. So, you know, we're looking at inputting senses of the brain, and this is looking at taking the signals from the brain to make a new experience.
One of the questions I wanted to ask you both, perhaps we'll start with Adrian, is, are there any sort of physical or psychological dangers in this sort of new virtual world that we're sort of encountering?
Of course, with any kind of new technology or new media, there's a problem of addiction, you know, so people can get addicted. But, you know, you already have the phenomenon of teenagers or young people, so addicted to computer games that they don't want to leave their bedroom, they don't want to do anything else. So I think this is an issue we have with any, when we introduce any kind of new media. But I think, you know, that this is why we have to work very closely with social scientists and people who will help to make new kinds of education. How can we use this technology? But, you know, in some way, we already live in a virtual world. I was told a story that 80 years ago when someone saw a giraffe at the zoo, you know, he was so excited as a young boy. But when he took his grandson, no excitement at all, because they've already seen the giraffes on Discovery Channel, and really in the wild in Africa. So I think we already live in the kind of virtual world. So our reality is changing because we're immersed in digital media all the time.
Brendan, would you sort of see any potential pitfalls in this?
Yes. I mean, I think the first point I'll make is, at the forefront of technology, it's often quite uncertain what the lasting physical or psychological repercussions could be. So obviously need to carefully monitor that. But There was one phenomenon I was really interested in was the electromagnetic stimulation of the vestibular system. And it was found if you could put an electromagnetic current across the head, you could stimulate the tiny hairs in the vestibular system and make people actually feel that they were experiencing some very small element of G-force left or right. And I was interested in monitoring on roller coasters the amount of G that people are experiencing in real time and then switching on the headset to make it feel even greater than they're experiencing. I did actually go and seek some advice from a neurologist, and he said, please don't do it. You might cause lasting damage. Well, but I've seen videos online of students in Japan doing this blindfolded and steering each other around car parks. So I thought people having great fun. But it's kind of where when you're working at that sort of forefront, you have to be, you know, work with some pretty smart cookies to make sure we're not causing any lasting damage.
Kit, you had a question you wanted to bring in.
With all this technology, there's a collision of the social and the virtual. Do we risk distancing ourselves further from one another if we continue to go down this path? So, for instance, in the fairground, if rides became more virtual, would we be isolating ourselves? And in your case, Adrian, if we replace human relationships entirely, do we not then, you know, find ourselves more alone? I guess Brendan first.
So neurosis for me is a very good example because it is a physical ride. It's a site-specific art installation, essentially, and it does rely on physical presence of an audience and the reality of an individual rider performing to the audience, whether they're essentially blindfolded and immersed in a different world or a different experience. It's very real. To ride your own fairground rides at home, let's say even if they're linked remotely as some kind of telepresence fairground experience, would be soulless, and I don't think could survive without that element of physical presence and also rich social interaction. Unless, of course, Adrian's field becomes incredibly rich. So I'll be watching Adrian very closely.
I think it's going to be a very long time before we replace physical reality. Basically, if you look at young children, you can see why do we enjoy roller coasters? If you look at young children in the playground, they love to swing, and somehow the human brain loves these things such as swinging and motion and going at fast speed. And I think it's going to take a very long time before we can really simulate that or stimulate that with virtual reality. But whether it's in our lifetime or later, I do believe that eventually we're going to get to the point where, virtual reality will be, almost as real. And instead of visiting, Disneyland, you basically, you put some kind of headset on and stimulate your brain. You can stimulate your physical and mental senses. I think eventually we will get there. I don't know how long that will take. But if you look at the neuroscience, already neuroscientists can connect optical fiber to a neuron of a mouse or a simple creature like a cockroach and control their motion using electrical signals. So, with the exponential increase of technology, I'm sure we're going to be eventually able to directly plug into our brain or stimulate our brain. At that point in time, I think it's going to be almost the same as physical reality, the virtual world, virtual physical sensations.
Is there any experience you think that virtual reality won't be able to simulate or to recreate?
Well, in some way, we live in an analog virtual reality because, the brain itself can't sense anything. If you remove your eyes and ears and, touch sensors, everything is actually being sensed. And, some frequency of light we perceive as red, but why do we perceive it as red? It's just a certain frequency of light. Something in our brain is converting a frequency of light to red. So in some way already, we live in a kind of virtual reality. Our brain itself can't sense the world. So, once we get to the point where we can directly input to the brain, I think that we'll be able to, simulate almost any experience in the physical world. But not only that, once we can do that, why stop at the physical world? Why not simulate that you're on flying to Mars or that you're a bird, So I think we can go beyond reality.
That sounds like an extremely exciting future that awaits for us all. Thanks to all of you. Future Fest is happening in London on March 14th and 15th, and you can find out more at futurefest.org. That's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to Brendan Walker, Kit Buchan, and Adrian David Chuk. From me, Nicola Davis, and all the science team, thanks for listening.